Hello! Welcome to Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here in the Brooklyn studio with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello, hello.
Welcome to Brooklyn, Emily.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's fun to have you here. Elizabeth Byers, you too are in Brooklyn.
I am, but not in the studio.
But not in the studio.
But hello, nonetheless.
Hello. This was a big week. There was a major Fed pivot, which we have to talk about, obviously. There was a lot of news on the labor relations front, because we're going to talk about Starbucks and what's going on with their unionization efforts. There was a lot of news on the sports pages with dollar numbers throwing around about Shohei Ohtani, who's a sports player. We're going to talk about him and his structure. There was a huge amount of news coming out of Dubai about the climate talks there. So we're going to talk about that in the Slate Plus. There were a whole bunch of other things we're just not even going to be able to get to. But this is a packed show. So it's all coming up on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We just saw some really amazing movement in the bond market. And this is something I love to geek out about because I think, as Slate Money listeners will all know, I think the bond market is much more interesting than the stock market. And what we have seen in the bond market is yields come down enormously. They're now like 10-year yields. They're like, they used to be 5%, now they're 4%. The mortgages that used to be 8% are now 7%. Interest rates are coming down. The real interest rates in the economy are coming down. Not the overnight rates that the Fed sets, but the long-term interest rates that really drive the economy have come down significantly. My question for you is, given that the Fed just kept its rates steady and they're still high, why is that? What happened?
Isn't it so crazy? Yeah, the Federal Reserve came out this week. Jerome Powell came out this week and did nothing. They didn't raise rates. They didn't cut rates. But yeah, rates are falling because Jerome Powell and the Fed have pivoted. They're now saying they expect, they're essentially leading the market to believe that they're going to cut rates maybe even three times next year. So people got really excited. And that drove
markets,
the change.
Markets anticipate future events. And this is a form of what the Fed loves to call forward guidance, which is basically we don't want lots of surprises. And they put out a dot plot. Elizabeth, are you a dot plot fan?
Yes and no. I pay attention to it, but I'm skeptical that it's that predictive of what actually happens.
But yeah, Elizabeth, maybe you should explain first. What is a dot plot?
So the dot plot is where all the Fed governors are polled on what they think is going to happen, and then their responses are plotted on what is literally a plot with dots.
Right.
And you can sort of tell overall what the directional indicator is for how the Fed is feeling at the moment.
And what we can see in the dot plot is that the median FOMC voting member is now expecting that there will be three rate cuts next year. As Elizabeth, as you say, that is not necessarily a effective prediction. The dot plots don't automatically come true. This isn't the kind of forward guidance where the Fed literally comes out and says, we are going to keep rates at zero for at least another 2 years. And that is an effective way of, you know, cutting rates and reducing expectations. They're not making any promises. They're just saying this is what we expect. But it's a massive, massive change in how they're communicating, how they're thinking about interest rates. Because up until now, they've been saying, we don't know, we might need to raise again. You know, we haven't conquered inflation. Rates are going to have to stay high and possibly even go higher in order to make sure that we tame inflation. And now suddenly they've come out and said, you know what? Actually, probably there's going to be room for three rate cuts. The markets actually have priced in even more than that next year. And then after next year, there's probably going to be another four rate cuts. Suddenly, all of the talk of rate hikes has gone out the window. And we've suddenly got a lot of talk of rate cuts. And that explains why interest rates have come down. But what I don't quite understand, Emily, is why, what changed? What changed within the Fed that they suddenly pivoted so aggressively from, you know, higher for longer to like, oh yeah, we've basically won, and so now we can start cutting rates?
I mean, they've had a really good run of data. The indicators, the economic indicators that the Fed watches in order to inform its decision making, have been looking good. CPI has come down. The Fed's preferred inflation gauge, the PCE, also
personal
down.
Personal consumption expenditures.
I think so. The target for inflation is 2%, and I think PCE is in the threes now. Don't quote me. Quote me, Felix nodded. And CPI is in the low threes also. So, I mean, it looks like inflation, it came down a ton over the past few months. And it's there's mission accomplished vibes coming out of the Fed, which makes me anxious.
Yeah, that's anxiety inducing. And I'm trying to think this through in terms of the Fed's dual mandate. It has a mandate to keep inflation low and an mandate to have full employment. I think we should probably be a bit explicit about like the rationale here, which makes perfect sense, which is what really matters in the economy is real interest rates rather than nominal interest rates. Mm-hmm. The way you determine like what is the real interest rate in the economy is you take the nominal interest rate and then you subtract the rate of inflation. If inflation is coming down, which it is, then even if you keep interest rates steady, what you're doing is you're increasing real interest rates. You're basically doing these stealth real interest rate hikes. Every time inflation comes down, that's another little hike to the real interest rate. And so at some point, in order to keep real interest rates steady, even without like cutting on the real front, you need to bring those interest rates back down just to keep up with falling inflation.
Right, because you don't want these stealth rate hikes happening anymore. You don't need them to happen. They cause a lot of pain.
Where does this put both of you on your personal dot plot scale? Are you optimists or pessimists about a soft landing?
Well, I mean, we have a soft landing. The soft landing is here, right?
Really?
Like
You're saying we've already landed the plane?
I think that's debatable.
The soft landing has, like, what everyone was like, we are in the middle of Q4 2023 now, right? And when people were talking about can there be a soft landing, and people were doing these surveys a year ago saying, like, in a year's time, are we going to have a soft landing or are we going to have a recession? The overwhelming consensus of economists was we are going to have a recession. And that didn't happen. And they said, and the overwhelming consensus of economists was we are going to have very much higher unemployment. And that didn't happen. The thing that did happen was we kept on having economic growth, we kept on having jobs growth, and we brought down inflation. This was like the Goldilocks scenario, the soft landing that everyone thought was highly improbable, but it happened. So like a soft landing does not mean we will never ever again have a recession. A soft landing means basically where we are right now actually happened in contravention to everyone's predictions.
But we're not, the plane has not landed yet. I mean, the problems that I'm speaking of still exist. Like,
soft landing did not include like an super healthy housing
market.
Everything
perfect, right.
The soft landing was just like, just look at those two key indicators that the Fed is mandated to care about, unemployment and inflation. Can you bring inflation down while keeping unemployment low? Everyone basically said, no, you can't. And they have proven, yes, you can.
But we're not at inflation target yet.
We're close enough.
How long do we need to see inflation drop for everybody to, consensus basis, agree that this is a sustainable soft landing? Emily's pointing to factors that, you know, could reverse course.
So first of all, I just want to say, like, sustainable soft landing is not a thing, right? Like, a soft landing is a place, and then from here on in, we can talk about like what's going to happen to unemployment, what's going to happen to inflation. But like, I think we've reached the soft landing, and the question is now, if we're forecasting, like, what's going to happen to growth, what's going to happen to inflation? You know, are we going to have a recession? These are new questions, right? But the idea that those 500 basis points of rate hikes were going to cause a recession. I think that has now been disproven. If there's a new recession, you know, that's in the future. What I think in terms of inflation, you know, the war has not been won. The Fed governors have all very, very consistently saying, you know, a lot of what we're seeing in the inflation numbers right now is gas prices coming down and shelter prices coming down, like rents are coming down nationally as well. And that's important and that's good, but it's not core inflation.
Rent inflation is coming down. Rents aren't barely budging, but rent inflation is.
Rent inflation is coming down, but in a lot of the country, you actually do have rent deflation. You have rents which are significantly lower than they were a year ago. And that's good and that's healthy, but it does raise a worrying possibility that there is like sticky core inflation in, you know, basic goods and services that might be harder to bring down. And so the Fed is not declaring victory at all. But, you know, apropos what we talked about earlier, they can still keep real interest rates steady in order to, you know, at a high level, they can keep real interest rates high in order to try and eradicate whatever pockets of core inflation there might still be, while still bringing nominal interest rates down because of all of that success they've already had on the inflation front.
All right. You heard it here. Felix, think we have landed. We are in a soft landing.
I mean, do you not agree?
I guess I agree. It seems like with rates still high, it's still a question mark. And the job market, I guess, is strong. But if you look at the job gains we had in November, it was just in three categories: government jobs, healthcare jobs, and leisure and hospitality. Besides that, no real job growth in November. Like, I don't think things are so healthy. But I guess
but that's what
you're saying
means,
is true.
Right?
Yes, like, it's soft, right?
Yeah,
that's what
soft.
They wanted. But I guess, yeah, it's hard to stop time and declare something over when we keep moving forward in the economy. Do you know what I mean? Because you don't really know what's
getting,
happened.
We're getting really ontological here.
I mean, because it is really ontological, actually. Like, it's hard to know what's going on in the moment it's going on. So your confidence, I mean, I buy your argument, but I'm kind of like, well, we'll see what happens, you know?
Emily's got her worried pessimist hat on.
Yes.
But I feel like we should get her to put her happy optimist hat on, and we'll do that after the break.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
We're talking about Starbucks.
Yes.
And and Starbucks is being much more friendlier to unions than what it used to be. This is what I read in Axios Markets by Emily Peck. And I feel like if I know anything about Emily Peck, this is something that would make you happy, right?
I don't know, Felix. So I wrote this story. What is clear is that Starbucks has kind of like a little bit changed, has clearly changed its messaging around the union, starting as soon as the new CEO took over, starting in March when the new CEO took over from Howard Schultz.
Howard Schultz was famously a very anti-union CEO slash founder of Starbucks. Yeah.
Howard Schultz was like personally aggrieved that Starbucks workers would want to be in a union when his company treats its workers so well. Like, I think that was like what was going on in his head. And the new guy took over and, you know, he said he made some statements about we have to take better care of our employees. And at the same time, Starbucks kept fighting. They've had all these complaints filed at the National Labor Relations Board, and Starbucks is aggressively fighting them. It has a law firm, Littler Mendelsohn, that is aggressively fending off the union. But at the same time, it does seem to have softened its rhetoric, and Starbucks is now saying they want to negotiate contracts with the union in 2024 and get that done. And that kind of surprised me because it seemed like the Starbucks union would never get to a first contract, which is obviously quite important.
So a little bit of background here. Famously, Starbucks stores have to unionize store by store, but they are slowly unionizing. In terms of the negotiation, once they've unionized, are they then part of one big union and that one big union can negotiate on the behalf of all of the stores that have unionized?
That's really something that they have to bargain over. Right now, Starbucks is saying we want to negotiate contracts one by one. Okay, and there's 300 or so stores that have unionized. And if they carry through with that promise, it's going to be a very, very long haul. I mean, we saw how union negotiations go with UPS. It takes some time. But there's nothing stopping Starbucks and the union from agreeing, like, we'll just negotiate one master contract, and then, you know, and then everyone will have something similar in the network. Like, they could do that. I'm not sure they will do that. So I guess what I'm saying is Starbucks has changed its tone, and they put out a whole audit this past week saying that they're going to do even better and they're going to make it more clear that they support workers' rights to unionize and all this. But I'm still not sure, like, what that's going to translate into.
Well, you know, one of the stats that came out of the story is that, you know, 40% of the charges filed against the company for unfair labor practices were really around disciplinary actions. And in their defense, they've noted that disciplinary actions have been issued at pretty much a similar rate for both union and non-union shops. And they're sort of using that as a defense that there is no explicit anti-union playbook for the company, which is probably technically true, but I think, you know, generally speaking, culturally, it's been very anti-union and, you know, the evidence doesn't look great on that front.
So the NLRB found that out of the 113 odd Starbucks stores that were closed last year, 23 of them were illegally closed for anti-union reasons. The Starbucks is basically saying, no, we closed a bunch of stores and some of them were unionized and most of them weren't. Emily, what was the NLRB's reasoning there? And do you kind of agree with them?
The gist is Starbucks closed those stores to shut down unionizing efforts. Of the 23 stores, I believe only 7 or 8 had already voted to be in a union and the others hadn't yet. So they believe that they shut them down to discourage those workers from going further with unionizing efforts. And they said, like, Starbucks didn't give any of those workers the opportunity to work at other stores, which is sort of a sign like they just want to get rid of those people. That's the argument. It's a decision from one administrative law judge. And it looks like the National Labor Relations Board is going to ask or going to try to get a ruling saying Starbucks has to reopen the stores and try and force them to reopen the stores. I just don't think that's possible. Like, I don't think that will ever happen.
But do you think that the finding is broadly true? Do you think that, like, under cover of closing 113 stores, Starbucks did take the opportunity to close down the pesky unions?
You know, I really don't know. I read through the opinion from the judge, and It's not clear to me. I mean, Starbucks did close like hundreds of stores in 2022 and opened some stores too. From what I understand, it's hard to really know. What do you think, Elizabeth?
Well, they also have had slowing sales and the market has reacted to that. So there is a, you know, a plausible reason for closing stores that it has nothing to do with unionization.
Yeah.
Although I'm generally skeptical that, you know, they're not fighting it.
Right. They could have been done with this union push a long time ago. They could have said, oh, great, we have unionizing stores. You know what? Let's get together. Let's do a master contract. And let's do this. Like, we respect unions. And if our workers weren't organized, like, let's go for it. But that is 100% not what they've done.
they certainly would never have done that under Howard Schultz. But it seems like they might be.
Yeah.
Might be drifting in that direction now.
I think
we have
so.
A slightly more union friendly employer verse than we did a year ago. So, you see, happy Emily.
Yay.
Yay. Okay. I want to take a break and talk about the most highest paid union member probably in the world.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
There is a players union in MLB, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And MLB, for those of us who don't speak sports ball, stands for Major League Baseball, which is a big sport here in America. And there's this chap named Shohei Ohtani, who is very good at playing baseball. And he just signed a contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers to play baseball for them for the next 10 years. And when this contract was initially reported, this very large number got thrown around of $700 million. And everyone said, oh my God, that's a $700 million contract over 10 years. That works out to $70 million a year. And people got very excited because that's a lot of money. Then, after a little bit more reporting and details started coming out, it turns out that he isn't actually being paid $17 million a year. He's being paid $48 million a year, which is still a lot of money.
Yeah.
But my friends who care about these things tell me that even though it's a huge amount of money and more than anyone else is getting, it is less than some sort of vague, touchy-feely idea of what he is, quote-unquote, worth. And he seems to have said something similar. He's basically saying, I didn't want the Dodgers to use up their whole payroll on me because what I really want to do is win championships. And obviously, to win a championship, you need an entire team. One person can't win a championship. And I need them to have enough money to pay the rest of the people on the team enough money to win a championship.
That sounds a lot more plausible to me than the other explanation, which is that he's making a complex bet on interest rates.
Well, so there are two separate things going on here. And one of the things that is very confusing is that people are very much confusing the two. The first question is, did Shohei Ohtani effectively take a pay cut from what he could have demanded in order to maximize the chance of winning a championship? And is the $48 million he's being paid per year lower than he could have demanded? And I think the broad consensus on that one is yes.
I don't understand what you're saying about $48 million. My understanding is he signed a 10-year deal. Everyone said it was a $700 million deal. But what's actually happening is he's getting $2 million a year until the end of the contract when 10 years is over. And then he gets like a lump sum.
The $48 million a year is split into two parts. There is $2 million of cash salary that is going to Shohei Ohtani for each of the first 10 years.
Okay, okay? Got it. Good.
On top of the $2 million of cash, the LA Dodgers are also paying $46 million a year into an escrow account. That escrow account then earns interest over the course of 10 years. Uh-huh. And then, so for each of the 10 subsequent years, after Ohtani has presumably stopped playing, that escrow account will then pay out $68 million a year to Ohtani for, you know, between, I think, 2034 and 2043 or something like that.
I have another question.
Yeah.
I'm raising my hand. You can't see this, but it's true. The idea was to keep the Dodgers from spending a lot of money so they could spend money on other players. If they're putting all the money every year into an escrow account, aren't they spending the money?
So, yes. What they are doing is they are spending $46 million and putting it into an escrow account. But the point is that $46 million, even or $48 million if you include the $2 million of cash, uh-huh. is lower than what he could have demanded. So they're saving money compared to the, say, $50 or $60 or $70 million that maybe he could have demanded. But he was like, I will take less than that. I will take $48 million in order to give you more scope to hire more players and win championships.
So then why wouldn't he just take it right away?
Okay. So that's the second issue.
Okay.
Which is kind of what Elizabeth was talking about, which is this whole financial legerdemain of how that $48 million a year is being paid.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're talking about, which is like it's being paid in the future and it's being held in escrow accounts and he's not being paid it directly and he's going to not get it until, you know, another 20 years for the final payment and all of that weird shit. People are like, there must be something nefarious going on here. And Elizabeth, I'm super interested in whether you think there is something nefarious going on here.
I do not. The two theories that seem to have little hints of nefariousness are that he's, you know, again, making some complex bet on interest rates, or that he's doing this because his earnings get taxed differently in California if they're retirement earnings. I think the more plausible explanation is that the values for players who are, you know, superstars in their industries, not just tied to team salaries and bonuses, they're tied to things like sponsorship deals that really the value of which go up if you're playing on a championship team versus, you know, a kind of middle of the road team.
But again, like we're not answering Emily's question. We're not answering the question of why is he taking a below market salary, right? We've understood that he's taking a below market salary in order to win championships. Like that's stipulated. The other part of the question is why is he structuring his below market salary in this weird way? Why does the contract pay out over the course? Why does the 10-year contract pay out over the course of 20
why?
Years?
Why?
Okay. I actually am going to take the other side of Elizabeth on this one. I think there is an income tax thing going on. That when he's not playing for the Los Angeles Dodgers, he no longer needs to live in Los Angeles or even in California at all.
Sure.
When you don't live in California, you don't need to pay California income tax. And that he will presumably live somewhere else, maybe back in Japan or maybe in some tax haven somewhere. And all of this money that he winds up getting paid from the Dodgers will not be subject to the California income tax that he would have to pay if he was being paid it today.
So he's not only a Los Angeles Dodger, he's a tax Dodger.
Well
dropping
done.
The mic here.
Well done, Emily. But that is Ohtani tax, right? That is Ohtani income tax. That is not the other tax that people are talking about here, which is the so-called luxury tax on teams that pay their players too much.
Okay, that's different.
That's different.
And I don't think
there's a luxury tax dodge going on here.
That actually makes a ton of sense to me. You don't want to pay a big tax bill for the next, you know, every year for the next 10 years. So you put it off 10 years and then you hopefully have moved somewhere where you pay lower taxes.
Yes. And also you hopefully will not have seen that money eroded by inflation. So you are expecting inflation to be low. Our colleague Neil Irwin made the point that if you're Japanese, you just don't really know of inflation. Inflation is something that doesn't really exist in Japan. And that, you know, you'll be like, oh, you know, I'll just take it in the future because it's worth the same in the future. In fact, it's worth more in the future than it is in the present. That's how you get from the 48 million to the 70 million, is by including all of the interest that the money is going to earn over that decade that it's in escrow.
I guess you're betting that the inflation won't be as bad as the tax, in other words.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And possibly if he wants to move back to Japan, you're making a long-term bet on the dollar-yen exchange rate.
But like, at the end of the day, this is all a ton of money. And like, why does it matter that much? 48 million, 70 million, 20 million. My God, like, we should be so lucky to have these dumb problems.
Well, this is the other thing that I wrote about in my newsletter this week, right? Which is that he is a hugely wealthy man already.
Yeah.
He's 29 years old and he just came off a $30 million one-year contract. And he's earning, depending on who you believe, somewhere in the region of $40 to $45 million a year in endorsement deals, right? So he has plenty of cash coming in.
Yeah.
And this is one of the interesting things, that for normal people like you and me, what we do is we live on our income and we're worried that maybe something might happen to our income. We might get fired or laid off, or we become unable to work for some reason. And then we're like, and then what am I going to do? And then what we say to ourselves is, well, I also have some savings. I have some wealth. And if I lose my income, I can fall back onto my wealth to be able to support myself.
Mm.
For very rich people, sometimes that can be reversed. Let's say you're a very rich person like Shohei Ohtani.
Sure.
And you have more than enough wealth to be able to support yourself from day to day for the next 10 years. You kind of don't need any income to do that.
Right.
But you're also worried that, like, weird shit can happen to wealth. You know, he's a baseball player. He's not a markets wizard, right? Maybe he, you know, goes crazy and blows it all. Like, there's lots of stories of athletes who go bankrupt because they blew all of their money on stuff. Maybe he chooses bad advisors. Maybe the money gets misappropriated. Maybe he makes bad investments. Maybe he buys a baseball team that goes bust. Like, there's any number of weird, like, people with lots of money, the number one thing they worry about is, what if I lose my money? What if I lose my wealth? And there are various reasons, you know, what can I trust myself not to squander this cash? And instead of using wealth as a backup to income, what they do is they use income as a backup to wealth. What Ohtani is doing with this contract is he's basically saying, even if I somehow manage to squander all of my wealth over the next 10 years while I'm playing for the LA Dodgers, even if I lose everything and throw it all away, I am still going to wind up with a nice, happy income of $68 million a year for the following decade. And that can, you know, that's going to be able to support me. I don't need my wealth if I have that guaranteed income.
Rich people problems. Man, what even?
So the glorious thing about this is it happens to have coincided with someone else in California winning the Mega Millions jackpot. And this person, it looks very much like, bought two identical lottery tickets at this gas station in Encino, California, with the same numbers. Now, Elizabeth, I'm assuming that you might have played the lottery once or twice, but you've never bought two identical lottery tickets with the same number, right?
Not that I know of, no.
This is not a common thing for people to do.
It's really weird.
You have to kind of think through, why would someone do that? And the reason you would do that, the obvious main reason why you would do that, or one possible reason why you would do that, is when you win the lottery, you get a choice. Do I want it as a lump sum, or do I want it as a annuity that goes up by 5% a year for 30 years? And if you have two lottery tickets, you can literally split that. You can have half of it as the lump sum and the other half as the income. And then you kind of get the best of both worlds, because you become wealthy from the
instantly wealthy
jackpot number one. But you also know that lottery winners are a little bit like athletes. They have a famous history of going bust on a regular basis because they've squandered all their wealth in random ways, right? And so then with the other half of your jackpot win, you have that guaranteed income for the next 30 years. That means that you don't need to worry about squandering your wealth, because you know you're going to be fine for the next 30 years anyway, because there's this other income stream that you don't really have control of, and it's just going to come to you on an annual basis.
Which would you rather have? This is important. Felix, then Elizabeth, you answer. If you had to choose between the lump sum and the annuity payments when you won the lottery, which are you picking?
I have two answers to that. My first answer is I would love to do this clever thing of splitting it in half. I think that's a great
way of
doing it.
That's your strategy going to be going forward.
I will always buy two copies of every lottery ticket. No, but if I had to choose, I would. My feeling is basically, if I expect to live for another 30 years, then probably there's a lot of attraction to taking the annuity because it does take a bunch of like financial stress off your shoulders. You know what you're going to do. There are tax reasons why it makes sense because effectively the interest that you're earning on that money accrues tax free instead of like having to do it with pre-tax money. And it also just means I don't need to, you know, I have fewer people coming up to me and saying, you're a billionaire now, I need your money, because I'm like, no, I don't actually have any money. I'm just getting an income. I'm not, you know, I didn't make all of this money. So on the other hand, if I'm like in my, you know, 60s,
right,
I'll be like, I'm not going to enjoy this for the next 30 years. So give me the money now.
Right. That's pretty solid. I was going to say, yeah, if I knew I was going to die like relatively soon, I would take the lump sum. So what happens if you are getting the annuity and then you die, do they pay it out to your heirs?
Yeah. But that, by the way, is dangerous.
Oh, because they'll kill you.
Well, no, it's not that your heirs will kill you.
The moral
You'll be
hazard
murdered.
The problem is that like the annuity winds up getting paid to your heirs rather than to yourself because you're dead. But that's inheritance of your heirs. Mm-hmm. That inheritance has a present value. Mm-hmm. Your heirs need to pay inheritance tax on that present value, but they don't have the money to pay the inheritance tax because they haven't received the money yet.
Oh, no.
And so then they basically need to borrow against those future earnings in order to pay the inheritance tax. So it gets a bit complex.
Yeah. And if interest rates are high, that could be costly.
Yeah. So how about you, Elizabeth? Which are you going to choose when you win the jackpot?
My honest answer is that I couldn't answer this question without a team of tax lawyers, estate lawyers, and financial advisors. I mean, I can make an NPV model myself, but my inclination would be to go with the annuity. But I also think, you know, my investment choices would be fairly conservative. So that's kind of more in keeping with what I would normally do.
It's a lot to think about. And it's just baseball got us here.
you can just imagine Shohei Ohtani like sitting down with his tax and estates lawyers and just being like, this is not a meeting I want to have. I think we should have a numbers round. Emily, do you have a number?
My number is $11 million. $11 million is how much money Red Lobster lost, a quarterly loss for Red Lobster, an operating loss.
I do love this number.
Because they miscalculated how much their endless shrimp promotion would cost them. So the endless shrimp promotion is just you can go to Red Lobster and you can order as many shrimp dishes as you want endlessly and fill yourself up, eat as much as you want. And they used to do it, you know, at special occasions, just on Mondays, limited promotions. But then for some reason, they decided in the fall, like, we're just going to do endless shrimp endlessly.
Endless shrimp.
endless shrimp.
There's no end to the endless shrimp.
And they only charge $20, which, by the way, is only a few dollars more than it costs to get a salad in Manhattan right now. $20 and you can have all the shrimp you want. People went bananas for it. Everyone went to Red Lobster, only ordered the endless shrimp, and then they lost a bunch of money.
They went bananas for the shrimp.
Now they're back to finite shrimp, I assume.
No, that's the thing. They're sticking with it. They just raised the price from $20 to $25, but they're still sticking with it. They'll figure it out, and I think people get really excited about it. I know I am.
I mean, have you ever eaten at a Red Lobster?
No, I haven't.
Do you think it sounds cool? Do you think like endless shrimp option is going to make you more likely to eat at a Red Lobster?
Well, see, Felix, here's the thing. Like, I thought endless shrimp was just like literally just shrimp, you know, like endless shrimp cocktail, which to me sounds amazing. But a lot of the dishes you have to buy like come with, you get a shrimp and like some rice on the side, and it's like all super prepared. I forgot what your question was, honestly, but I don't know.
It sounds like there are asterisks. You can't just get endless shrimp. You need to be getting like
They're not like making it rain shrimp over your head or anything.
It's not like the breadsticks at Olive Garden.
Right.
Elizabeth, what's your number?
My number is 19.2, and that's $1 million. And that's the amount of money a guy, 27-year-old named Dryden Brown, which is his real name, raised for a crypto state in the middle of the Mediterranean. That is,
well, on the edge of the Mediterranean, to be like, I don't think. Well,
yeah, technically, we don't really know where in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I don't think he's actually found a piece of land, but in principle, he would like to find a piece of land somewhere on the Mediterranean.
Yeah, so the philosophical roots of this thing are that, according to him, this crypto state, which is called Praxis, by the way, because of course it is, denounces enemies of vitality who reject European beauty standards, which is, you know, not at all creepy and totally normal. So unsurprisingly, of the people who have signed up for this thing, the ratio of men to women is 4-1. But the most remarkable detail, and there was a Time story about this earlier this week, I just have to read this verbatim. It says, in an undated Instagram story from inside the Praxis office that was reviewed by the New York Times, a man measured Mr. Brown's face using calipers, one of the main tools of physiognomy, the pseudoscience of judging character from facial characteristics, and of phrenology, the discredited science of predicting mental traits by measuring bumps in the skull. Mr. Brown did not clarify in his email response why he wanted his head measured.
I mean, yeah, there are some weird people in crypto land.
Well, also, this guy's only prior job is that he worked for a hedge fund he got fired from, and there are people giving him $19 million. Well,
yeah, but $19 million is like is spare change down the back of the crypto sofa. I don't think, like, you're clearly not going to build a city for $19 million. You can't even buy an apartment
Lego
in the Bahamas.
City.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's a Lego city. This could explain a lot.
A virtual city.
And wait, they needed to measure his head to find out if he would fit in a Lego city.
Elizabeth, can you explain the beauty standards part? So they're rejecting the beauty standards for themselves?
No, there's another line in the story where the guy says that he wants to. His original idea was that he was going to attract crypto and tech bros to this thing by bringing in quote unquote hot women. So I think traditional Western beauty standards just basically means blonde Barbie types.
The first and last word on this was obviously Dr. Strangelove, right? Where they're talking about like life in a nuclear holocaust and how everyone's going to have to go down into mine shafts and like reproduce for multiple generations at the bottom of mine shafts.
Okay.
And they're like, well, obviously we need the important men like us in the war room. We all need to go down there because we're important. But then it is going to be on us to repopulate the planet. And so we're going to need lots and lots of different women to carry our babies. And that's going to be hard work for us. So we're going to have to make sure that these women are extremely beautiful so that we want to be having sex with them so that we can be impregnating them all. This is a whole speech in Dr. Strangelove that came out in like the 1960s. And that was satire back then, but now it seems to have become, you know, an actual crypto crazy thing.
It's a plan. Someone's plan.
I will beat neither of your numbers, but I'm going to do the same thing that both of you did, which is have a dollar number in the millions. My dollar number in the millions is $327 million. That is the amount of property tax that Columbia University and New York University don't pay every year because they are nonprofits and they are two of the largest landowners in New York City. And there is a bill coming up in Albany that basically is trying to enact a law that would force them to pay the $327 million that would be owed on their buildings if they weren't nonprofits, and to pay it to the City University of New York, the
Ooh,
state,
I love that.
The state university, or the city university rather, because CUNY could use that money.
Sure could. That's not going anywhere. That's the kind of thing that would get challenged to the Supreme Court, I would think, right? I mean, universities are nonprofits. They don't have to pay taxes. That's established.
There are many universities that do, well, there's this thing called pilots. They don't pay taxes, but they pay pilots. And the pilot is stand for payment in lieu of taxes.
Oh.
And lots of places do force certain types of nonprofits to pay pilots. You know, so there is a lot of precedent for that. So it can be done.
Interesting. Well, that should be done. That is extremely unfair. I mean, NYU owns what? A huge chunk of the city.
And so does Columbia. They're just different chunks. Like one's uptown, the other one's downtown.
And then they charge kids like $100,000 a year to go to these schools.
So.
More or less.
Ish. On which note, I think we'll wrap up Slate Money for this week. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks for sending in your emails to slatemoney@slate.com. Thanks to Jared Downing and Ben Richmond for managing to cobble together a studio in Brooklyn so we could record. And we'll be back on Monday with, you're going to love this one, the one and only Paula Scher going to the movies with us and watching This Is Spinal Tap.